17. With us today, we have Representative Clayman, Representative Tilton, Representative Tallarico, Co-Chair Culver. Excused is Representative Negyak and Representative Vasquez. And our thoughts and prayers go out to Representative Vasquez and her family in a difficult time for her family. Today, we have a presentation from the Alaska Power Authority, and we're going to do that for 45 minutes. We have Mira Kohler with AVEC, Jody Mitchell with the Inside Passage Electric Cooperative, and Crystal Enquist with the Alaska Power Association. And then we're going to run, that's going to have to run about 45 minutes, no longer. Then we're going to have the Alaska Energy Authority Director Sarah Fisher-Gode give a presentation and overview. And then we're going to take up and present House Bill 58 by Representative Christ Tompkins. We're going to give a presentation here of the bill, get some questions on the table, and then we'll hold that bill for another hearing. So, to keep us on time, we'll ask the presenters from APA to go ahead and get started and state your name for the record.
Good morning. I'm Crystal Enquist with Alaska Power Association.
Good morning. We have Representative Will Jonas. Go ahead.
Well, good morning. I'd like to thank you, Representative Culver, for this opportunity to address the House Special Committee on Energy. Again, my name is Crystal Enquist. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Power Association. And presenting with me today are Mira Kohler with Alaska Village Electric Cooperative and Jody Mitchell with Inside Passage Electric Cooperative. And Mira will be calling in via teleconference. So as far as what we'll be covering today, we will be talking about some programs that have successfully lowered the energy costs in Alaska. So we're going to highlight a few of them, and they are the Power Cost Equalization Program, the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, and the Emerging Energy Technology Fund. And then we've also built in a little bit of time for questions from the committee. So who we are, Alaska Power Association, we're the statewide trade association for the electric utility industry. And our the business model of our membership is pretty diverse. We have member-owned electric cooperatives, municipal-owned utilities, joint action agencies, and investor-owned utilities. So we have several types of electric utilities that are members of the trade association. And even though we have a diverse membership, APA is the place where we all come together and speak with one voice before lawmakers and regulators. So Alaska Power Association members provide power to a majority of Alaskans. So if you see here on the map, our members provide power from Barrow to Kodiak and then westward down to Unalaska, east in the Inside Passage, in the interior, in South Central Alaska. And then one of our members, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, they actually have 56 villages in western Alaska. We did not put all of those villages on the map, but it just shows the scope of the membership in Alaska Power Association. So before we get into the specifics of these programs, I wanted to frame this for you so you'd have a little bit of background information. I always think that's helpful. So if you take a look at this graphic, and I'm not sure how clearly you can see it, so my thought was that I would go over it briefly. But if you look at that pie chart in the upper left-hand corner, that shows the statewide electrical generation in Alaska by energy source. And what the pie chart shows us is that 58% of electric generation is natural gas, 20% is hydro, 16% is diesel, 5% is coal, and wind. On this graphic, it says it's about a 0.3%, but wind's actually now about 2%. So that's what we're looking at right now as far as the energy generation mix in Alaska. And then taking a look at the state, and I realize it's a little bit tricky to see this again, so I'll just cover it briefly. But if you take a look at the state and you look up on the North Slope, that shows that the fuel sources up there in Barrow, they are lucky to have a nice abundance of natural gas. in some of the other communities along the slope, they have diesel fired generation. If you look at the west coast of the state, you'll see some symbols for wind generation and also diesel. Looking in the interior, again, they're lucky to have a nice supply of coal. They also have diesel fired generation and some wind in the mix. South Central, that is primarily natural gas generation. We do have some hydro and some wind. Southeast, Southeast is lucky here to be to have the abundance of hydro that it has. And then I'll note that Kodiak Electric is almost 100% renewable. So that's pretty exciting. But that just shows you the diversity of fuel sources that we have for the electric generation in Alaska. So moving into our first program that we're going to highlight, Mira Kohler is the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. She has about 30 years of experience in the Alaska electric utility industry. She's headed NACNEC Electric Association, Anchorage Municipal Light and Power, and she is, as I've said, the head of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Mira is considered the state's foremost expert on the PCE program. And so she will give just a brief overview of AVEC, and then she will talk about some specifics of the PCE program. Mira, are you online?
I am.
Great. Take it away.
All right. Thank you so much, Crystal, and Chairman Culver and your team. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present, and I'm sorry I can't be there in person. I will be there tonight, but unfortunately today's meeting is today, not tomorrow. And as Crystal said, my name is Mira Kohler. I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Co-op. I have been here at AVEC since 2010, so 15 years now. I have about 23 years of experience managing utilities across the state, including one rail belt utility, so I've got a fairly diverse background there. To give you a little overview of Alaska Village Electric Co-op, we are headquartered in Anchorage, but we serve 56 communities across the state. The largest of those is Bethel, which we acquired last year, and the majority of the others are an average size of about 450 individuals, and they are villages primarily in western Alaska, but we do have one system on the road, which is Minto, and we have a community in Kodiak Island as well as a few in Bristol Bay. So we are spread out quite widely across the state. The pictures you see here in this particular graphic are all from AVEC. They show you what some of our communities look like. They're very small communities, very remote. They're almost entirely diesel-powered, but we have been very active in installation of wind generation. So we actually own 34 wind turbines in our communities, so we do have the largest in the state, the largest fleet, albeit not the largest generators in the state. And it actually accounted for about 6% of our gross generation last year, which came from wind. We are a major consumer of the Power Cost Equalization Program, and that is because the cost of energy in rural Alaska is so very high, and it's associated with the high cost of diesel. There's been a lot of questions as to why the cost of diesel has not gone down in rural Alaska yet, and that is because all of the diesel is actually purchased during the open water season of the year, which closes in October of the year. So all our fuel was purchased at last year's prices, so we perforce must utilize that fuel before we can buy new fuel and enjoy those lower prices. So to give you a little overview of power cost equalization itself, if you'll go to the next slide, what it'll tell you is that the residential electric rates in rural Alaska range from a low of about 36 cents a kilowatt hour to a high of over $1.80 a kilowatt hour. The 36 cents is enjoyed in the much larger communities, so basically the Nomes and the Bethels and the Unalaskas, places like that where they're able to spread their economies of scale over much larger kilowatt hour sales, there the cost of power is significantly lower. But in small communities like Lime Village, Chuapalak, and others like that, the cost can be as high as $1.80, especially when you have to fly fuel in, which happens in several of our villages as well. This high cost of power just absolutely cripples economic development. So even though the Power Cost Equalization Program exists, we have to recognize that it only provides relief to about 20% of the electricity that is sold in the state, maybe the 25-28%. All of the energy that's used by commercial enterprises, which is what, of course, fosters economic development, is purchased at full cost. And so you are typically looking in a village at a full cost of power of 50 to 60 cents a kilowatt hour. So as a result, economic development is stifled. PCE was established in FY85, and that the reason why that is significant is because that is when the state of Alaska finally determined that despite all the studies that had been conducted to find an affordable way to provide energy to rural Alaska, there really was no alternative to diesel fuel because these communities are small and spread far out, and there's no technology that is viable that can lower that cost. And so the PCE program was established, and it was a successor to other programs that had actually begun in 1980, which were designed to reduce the high cost of power in rural Alaska. When the program was established, all users received PCE on the first 700 kilowatt hours, but because of funding constraints, many of you will remember that in 1986, the cost of a barrel of oil dropped to $9 a barrel. That pretty much crippled or eliminated many programs in the state of Alaska, and PCE also was cut back severely. So now, no commercial customers receive PCE, and no state government or federal government entities receive PCE either. That reduced the cost of the program by about 40%. So as you can see, there is an annual appropriation of about $40 million of recent to fund the PCE program. That represents about 20% of the cost of producing electricity in rural Alaska. So 80% of the cost of producing energy is carried by the local community. That $40 million is allocated. The RCA, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, is the one that computes the amount of PCE that is to be allocated to each community, and residential consumers get it on the first 500 kilowatt hours used, and community facilities, things like street lights, water and sewer operations, get it on up to 70 kilowatt hours per resident per month. So that does help local commercial operations of municipal type services. AVEC actually represents, at this particular point, since we also serve Bethel, we represent about 41% of all of the PCE that's used in a community, in Alaska. So it's a very important feature for us. And the way PCE is distributed to the communities is that the utility actually posts a credit to each consumer's account each month, and it goes out to the consumers. After it is billed, we then turn around and bill the Alaska Energy Authority for the PCE that was distributed to those communities. So it is a direct pass-through to the consumer. Even though it comes to the utility, it's just a reimbursement of the credits that were already issued by that utility. So if you'll go to the next slide, you'll see all the communities. There are the dots on the state of Alaska that show you where all of PCE is received. Conspicuous in its absence is the rail belt. None of the communities in the rail belt received PCE. That's because by statute, they were eliminated. And the reason for that was that they were already beneficiaries of major programs such as reduced cost of natural gas, as well as the hydro project and interties that were built at state expense to serve those communities. You'll also see a very sparse distribution of PCE on the North Slope. That's because there are only a handful of villages up there. Those villages are also very heavily subsidized in the cost of electricity by the North Slope borough itself. So the rates over there are artificially set at 15 cents a kilowatt hour, which is only about a quarter of what their actual costs are. PCE remains a very major lifeline program for rural Alaska. Currently, the entire amount of PCE is funded by spinoff, as it were, from the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund, which is the next slide. To tell you a little bit about the PCE Endowment Fund, This was essentially a compromise program that was established starting in 2000, and it was initially set up and capitalized with $100,000 from the Constitutional Budget Reserve and the proceeds from the sale of the four dam pool projects, which were four hydro projects that were built in the mid-1980s to serve the five communities of Valdez, Kodiak, Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Petersburg. Those projects were sold back to the communities for about $85 million. So the first infusion of money to the PCE Endowment Fund was the $100 million, and then the $84 million from the sale of the Four Dam Pool project. Then a few years later, Governor Murkowski added another $187 million to the Endowment Fund. That was a compromise agreement between urban and rural Alaska to cover urban projects and then a rural component. And then a final appropriation of $400 million was added to the Endowment Fund a few years ago, essentially by Senator Lyman Hoffman at the time. Again, compromise funding to represent parity between rural Alaska and urban Alaska. So a modest total of about $750 million in that Endowment Fund has actually now grown, and currently it's at $950 million as of January 31st of this year. The statute allows up to 7% of the average principal balance of the Endowment Fund over the previous 5 years to be appropriated for the PCE program. And so that has been used last year. That was the first year that it was adequate for the previous 5 years to cover that the cost of PCE, and should continue into the future. It is a very important pool of money that permits power cost equalization to move forward, and I hope that nothing ever happens to disturb that endowment fund. And that more or less covers my presentation of PCE, the endowment fund, and a wee bit about AVEC, and you're welcome to ask questions now, or if you wish, we can wait until the end of our presentation and do it then.
Does any members of the committee have any questions? Representative Wolf?
Thank you. Is any of the endowment or any of the funds at all used for other sources of alternative energy, or is it just to supplement diesel fuel?
The power cost equalization is available to communities that were eligible in 1984 for PCE. So, for example, take the community of Cordova. Cordova back in 1984 was 100% diesel, and since then has built two hydro projects that now, I think they now provide about 80% of the electricity that's used in Cordova. But because Cordova was eligible in 1984, it's eligible today. So it receives PCE on all of its kilowatt-hour sales and costs. So PCE is available for renewable, for even for communities that have renewable energy, providing part or all of their energy. However, it's not available as a source of capital for the construction of those projects. PCE, as I mentioned earlier, is a pass-through program that essentially just lowers the cost of energy to the end user, the end residential user.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, let's proceed then. Who's going to take on the next one?
Our next speaker is Jody Mitchell. She's the president and general manager of Inside Passage Electric Cooperative. Jody, like Mira, has many years of experience in the electric industry, both as a CFO and now as a CEO. Also, she is a Sea Alaska board member. She's also on the board of the Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee. So with that, I will turn it over to Jody. I'll move the mic.
Jody, just for the record, could you state your name again, please?
Yes, Jody Mitchell, and I'm the CEO of Inside Passage Electric Cooperative.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for letting me speak today. Before I get started, I wanted to just let you know a little bit more about Inside Passage Electric Cooperative, or also, as we fondly call ourselves, IPEC. And my board is here actually today, and so if you don't mind, if you would just give us a moment to introduce them, because it's one member, one vote, so each of our communities has one director, and I'll just start over here with Grace Villarreal from Luna.
Hi, Grace. Welcome.
And then in the blue shirt here, I have Larry Beck representing Chilkat Valley. That's from 10 Mile to the border up by above Haynes.
Welcome, Mr. Beck.
In the back row with the blue cap that says D on it, that's Christopher Hotch from Clequan.
Welcome, Christopher.
And Wilbur Brown representing Cake.
Hi, Wilbur.
And Richard George representing Angoon.
Hi, Richard.
And we're all up here to...
Quite a utility, it looks like.
Yeah, well, we have five communities, basically, that we serve, and we're all in here to do some work on the Hill and for the APA conference, and so I thought it would be a good opportunity for them to see you all in action, so thank
you
for allowing
me
that.
You represent a good cross-section of different energy challenges, small communities not connected to the grid.
Absolutely, and, you know, a lot of what my colleague Mara Kohler said about power cost equalization, I absolutely agree with. In fact, 100% I agree with. You know, power cost equalization is really one of the lifelines that keeps rural Alaska alive. One thing I don't know if Mira made clear is that each utility then has a different PCE rate, and it's based on their costs. So it's not like everybody gets the same flat thing. It's an amount that varies by your cost of power. And I think that's important for you all to know. So that if you do have renewables in the mix, as Representative Will was asking about, presumably you would build a renewable resource so that you could reduce power costs, and therefore that is reflected in the amount of PCE that the state pays out. So it would be a smaller amount. So renewables are good. We want renewables. Anyway, I'm here to talk to you about another great, important program that we have in the state, and that's the Renewable Energy Grant Fund. And I've been on the committee, the Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee, since its inception, so I was able to be there when they started creating policy around the program. It was created by the legislature in 2008, as you probably know. And, of course, it supports renewable energy projects, particularly in areas with the highest energy costs. In other words, the applications are scored in part on the cost of energy as well as local median household income. And so it helps to reduce costs to the high-cost areas on a more permanent basis than the power cost equalization program. And furthermore, I mean, in contrast, the PCE program only helps the residentials and the community facility sectors of our business, whereas a lower cost project would serve all of the community, including all the businesses. So that's important. The program is again administered by the Alaska Energy Authority. Grants are awarded basically in different phases of projects. So we have a reconnaissance stage, feasibility, design and construction. IPEC has had the great luck to be able to use this program for all the phases, and in fact I just wanted to let you know that I'd love to have you come out to Huna, which is just a 50 mile 20 minute flight west, I hope I'm pointing west, and to see the Gartina Falls project, which is currently under construction and will be commissioned later this spring. And it was built with a large portion of the money came from this renewable energy grant fund. A successful program in the renewable energy fund provides a large rate of return for the state's investment. And one thing I want to just mention is that, in Southeast we are able to do hydro because, of course, we have a large hydro resource here. And when these projects are scored, they're basically scored on a 30-year window, looking forward. But in fact, I would argue that the projects actually will, especially a hydro project, will last much longer than that. But they discount it based on net present value. But if you look forward, I think my colleague here, Tim, would tell you that he has hydro projects that are 100 years old and still operating, or well over 100 years old. He's nodding. So that's what we try to do anyway with the program dollars. So they last, really last forever with little maintenance. So far, since 2008, appropriations to the Renewable Energy Fund have totaled $247.5 million. And this funding has been matched with more than $152 million from other sources. But I want to say something about other sources. There's really not very many other sources anymore than the Renewable Energy Fund. And I think I've said this to some of you already, that the Renewable Energy Fund really is, in my view, the biggest hope we have in rural Alaska to get off diesel. And there really isn't another source. We've got the federal program, the High Energy Cost Grant Program, but that has very limited funding. And then you all know, or you hope you probably know, that the federal government doesn't consider hydro renewable. And so that's a real big frustration for us, because that means we have to go and get state dollars. They have a lot of programs in the federal government for hydro projects, but they're only for existing hydro projects to, you know, to beef up an existing project. So if you don't have one, that doesn't help you at all.
So is that something that we should bring to Senator Murkowski's attention, since she's chairing Senate Energy, that some legislation change at the federal level? I suppose it's wrapped up with salmon conservation and those kind of issues where they didn't include hydro.
Yeah, I believe so. I do think that the legislature passed some kind of an instrument, you know, urging the federal government to... Yeah, they did pass something to try and urge that change on the federal level, but I don't believe it's resulted in anything yet. But it sure doesn't hurt to remind them how important that is.
Yeah, well, how does the committee feel about maybe just a committee letter to the senator? Is that something we generate a draft letter for your consideration? All right, maybe have staff do that, and we'll send it to our committee, and maybe we'll just... If we can give us some help on sites of federal law that we would want to, or regulation changes. I don't think we have to be very specific. We have a fleet of lawyers back there, but bring it to their attention. Thank you. Go ahead.
I did want to add to Jody's comment. The senator is actually, she has been working on that issue for a few years proactively. I know that she's working on it. She has a good staff. Chuck LaSchulte in her office has been working on that as well. So just to know, I think some incremental progress has been made, but not quite where we'd like to see it.
Okay. Thank you. We'll coordinate with her staff then, and maybe be able to lend her some support.
Yeah, we should just all barrage them with why that's a bad policy. Moving on. In 2014, the Renewable Energy Fund projects displaced close to 15 million diesel equivalent gallons, and that number will continue to grow as more projects are completed. Since 2009, an estimated 347,575 metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions have been reduced. Renewable Energy Fund projects create local employment opportunities and local energy independence. And that's really important, too, because our rural areas really struggle with high rates of unemployment, and we do our best to employ local people during the construction phase of the projects. So we urge that the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, you know, that you continue appropriation sufficient to cover the projects and at the funding levels recommended by AEA. And we understand that there is a, you know, that we're in a funding crisis. But again, I just urge you to to consider that this is our, you know, really the best hope we have for rural Alaska to get off diesel. We don't want to be on diesel. We really don't. We want lower cost power. Projects recommended for funding that help advance Alaska's goal of producing 50% of the state's power with renewable energy by 2025. So, you know, this helps us with our long-term goals as a state also. Because, you know, I think back, if you look at back at one of the maps, much of rural Alaska is still on diesel. And so this would go a long ways to helping that as well. There is currently $15 million in the governor's FY16 capital budget for the Renewable Energy Fund, and we just want to, you know, urge you all to keep it there or to add to it. I don't actually, I shouldn't say add to it. That sounds greedy because I am, you know, we are very cognizant of this, of the budget situation. But this is such a good investment for us. So that's all I have on the Renewable Energy Fund at this time, unless you guys have any further questions.
Does anyone have any questions on the Renewable Fund? Okay, I don't see. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And I think it's a good program. Hopefully we're going to be able to find a few quarters in the cushions to keep that one going, but you never know. It's somebody's got to keep the lights on, though, right? Who's up next?
I'm going to go ahead and continue with the to talk a little bit about the Emerging Energy Technology Fund.
Okay.
And this is another.
Okay, we've got about 12 minutes, and then we're going to roll into the next.
Okay. Yeah, I think this is only one slide.
Thank you.
So, you know, I don't know as much about this program, unfortunately, but I do know enough to speak on it a little bit. But this is where we allow our scientists, our local, I think maybe ASAP probably does a lot of work in this program in trying to find new alternative energy sources. And so it's very critical. As we all know, Alaska is a resource-rich state. But learning how to tap some of those, some of that potential is very important for our future. And so, you know, we also urge that this program continue funding. There is $1 million in the governor's FY16 capital budget for this program as well, which is reduced significantly. I think it was $3 million at one time. So, you know, we hope that you will also allow that money to stay in. And that's all I have on that.
Okay, you're complete with, oh, you got a couple
yeah.
more.
No, that's it. That's
okay,
just,
do we have any questions for the presenter on renewable energy or power cost equalization? And I don't suppose there's enough earnings for the fund to look at helping out the schools or anything like that yet, or just not enough revenue generated from the PCE fund?
You know, I think I would defer to Mira on that. She knows much more about that. The endowment itself, we would, of course, love to see that happen. You know, as you know, I mean, even I think the biggest thing I notice is in the small communities, when you go to a small community, and I think the first thing you do, you should go to the grocery store and see how much they pay for groceries, because a lot of that cost is, you know, due to high cost of energy. But
sure.
I think Mira is going to answer.
Mira, you want to answer that real quick? Mira Kohler with AMEC. Thank you.
Yeah, yes. Actually, potentially, there is up to about $65 million that could be made available from the endowment fund for additional use for other programs such as schools or commercial users. The fact of the matter is that because school funding comes out of state coffers, so to speak, if a portion of that cost were to come out of the PCE program, it would essentially be money out of one pocket into another pocket. I think that if we were going to expand the availability of PCE, a very high priority should be to bring that PCE program to some of the small commercial users as well. And I know that Representative Bryson has introduced bills for the last few years to try and expand the PCE program to cover more eligible kilowatt hours, but those bills have not gone anywhere, and I would very definitely suggest and support expanding the program to at least provide a portion of assistance for commercial users as well.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, Representative. I have many people in my communities that urge us to try to get funding for the commercial.
Well, let's talk about the revenue generated from the fund then. So the fund's at about $0.96 billion, $959 million, the principal balance. And you said the expenditures are currently around $45 million, and the endowment is programmed to not exceed 7% of the principal amount of the fund as an expenditure. So there seems to be...
Yes, over the previous 5 years, so it's averaged out. It has only just gotten to where it'll spin off about $44 or $45 million. There are many that would say that allowing up to 7% as a takeoff off of the principal balance is a little high, and that that's not a sustainable amount. But 5 to 6% would certainly be sustainable. So I think that up to about $50 million could potentially come out of the PCE Endowment Fund. But I'm pretty sure that Sarah Fisher Goad, who is the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority, is there to present to you next, and she'll be probably wanting to touch on this a little bit as well, because she's been pretty involved in this program too.
Okay, great. Well, we'll hold our questions to her presentation. So am I correct in assuming that it's a proportional reimbursement on PCE depending on the total amount appropriated out of the fund every year? That's kind of a bit of a sliding scale on how much gets reimbursed to consumers?
Well, for the last several years, we have had full funding because there has been enough appropriated to cover full funding. There is, however, a formula in the statute that says, or a directive in the statute that says, that if not enough is available to provide full funding for PCE, then the PCE rate will be prorated by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to cover for the amount of funding available. There were many years in the 90s and early 2000s when we were sharply restricted on how much was available for PCE, and we were very often at about 65% of full funding. So in other words, if our PCE rate was 20 cents per kilowatt hour, we would only be getting 13 cents per kilowatt hour, and so the balance would be coming out of the consumer's pocket. But we have had full funding for the last, I would say, 8 or 9 years.
Can you recap for the record the amount, how many kilowatts are reimbursed, and at what rate, above what rate, how that typically works for the consumer? Let's just say you have power generated by your utilities, 50 cents. How many kilowatt hours are reimbursed, and or is it a certain set amount per kilowatt hour?
It is a set amount per kilowatt hour based upon the individual community's cost experience. So, for example, in one of our villages, if our cost of power is 50 cents a kilowatt hour, what will happen is that this is not the rate, this is the cost. So if we're selling it for 53 cents a kilowatt hour and our costs are 50 cents a kilowatt hour, then the RCA subtracts first the base rate, and that base cost is the average cost of power in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. And currently that's at about 14.5 cents. So that comes off the top, and then off the remaining balance, say it's 50 cents minus the 15 cents, that's 35 cents. That's then multiplied by 95%, and that is the PCE rate. So the consumer will then get that PCE rate on all of their consumption as long as it's under 500 kilowatt hours. If they use more than 500 kilowatt hours, then all the additional kilowatt hours are at full cost. So across the state, if you look at the annual report of PCE, about the average residential consumption is about 300 kilowatt hours per month. So in effect, they're leaving about 200 kilowatt hours worth of PCE on the table. But the reality is that their consumption fluctuates from summer to winter. So in the summer, typically their usage is very low. In our system, it's probably around 200 to 250 kilowatt hours a month. And in the winter, it's much higher because your lights are on longer and your heating system is on longer. So there are many customers who are using 600, 700, 800 kilowatt hours a month, and they're paying full price for anything over 500 kilowatt hours. So it's a moving target, and both the state and legislators have looked at various combinations of how they could allocate perhaps X number of kilowatt hours over a whole year or a flat amount each month that goes to the consumer, and none of those really have materialized to do any better than what we're currently doing.
Thank you for informing us. Some of us are kind of new to the PCE world. With AVEC, you have a number of rural utilities. Are any of those diesel generators you have out there convertible to other fuels like liquid natural gas? We have entrepreneurs looking at delivery of either propane or LNG to rural Alaska. What hurdles would you encounter in switching fuel source out of diesel? Would that take capital to upgrade your generators? Can you kind of brief us on what would be the hurdles there for your utilities?
I believe that most diesel-fired generators can take some portion of their fuel as another liquid, for example, propane. I think that what you'll find is that the efficiency of the diesel generator will go down because they're made to burn diesel fuel, not propane, so I think there may be some change in efficiencies. I think the biggest challenge with using another fuel source is how you're going to store it. Propane, for example, has to be stored in a pressurized container, and you have to remember that gallon for gallon, a gallon of propane only has about two-thirds of the BTU value of diesel fuel. So you would need much larger storage, so you would have to have additional storage capabilities, which, you know, obviously that can be done. One of the nice things about propane or liquefied natural gas is that when you spill it, it just goes up in the air. It doesn't
right.
damage
well,
anything.
Some of the proposals are being able to barge ship ISO tanks that can be loaded on a rail car, loaded on a, for instance, you go up to the rail to Nenana, put these on a barge, take them down river, and then you would, you know, have to haul the backhaul of the tanks, and you can use those tanks for storage. If that pencils out, those are expensive to build, so I'm interested in pursuing that angle, because I know the governor is, and how can we start getting gas, because we have to kind of think long-term. What diesel's not a solution that's good long-term for Alaska. And so I think the commitment of a number of us is, what are we going to do about our long-term power sources, and how do we make that transition? And if we have customers and markets and it makes economic sense, you know, the private sector will be moving product out to the villages in rural Alaska. So, you know, this is, as I'm learning about this myself, is how convertible are our assets out there to use a different fuel? Does that require a huge capital investment? I know we have a huge investment in all these diesel tanks, and we've upgraded our generation to be more efficient out there and managing power, a number of things around Alaska. But if we have a lower cost fuel than diesel and easier and safer to handle, what's going to be the hurdle?
I think that you'll find that certainly we would very much welcome anything that takes us off the reliance for diesel. You know, we have offered up our one and only village, which is on the road system, which is Minto, so it's on the road system from Fairbanks, and we could potentially use that as a guinea pig, if you will,
yeah,
to see what it would take to use an alternative fuel source. But I will tell you that one of the things that I have been promoting very heavily for the last couple of years is the construction of electrical transmission to interconnect the state of Alaska. That is something that is critically needed in the state of Alaska, both in the rail belt and across the state. Our industry is choking from the lack of energy availability. It's flat not available. So as a result, we're shipping all our natural resources outside instead of working on it in our state. And so anything that we can do to bring large amounts of low-cost power across the state is going to enhance our economy across the board.
Thank you. Appreciate your presentation. We have to switch out. We'll take a brief at ease while Alaska Energy Authority sets up. Record, we have the Alaska Energy Authority here to present a presentation on, you want to tell us what your presentation is, and we have Emily Ford with the Energy Authority. State your name for the record.
Yes,
please.
Thank you, Representative. My name is Emily Ford. I'm with the Alaska Energy Authority, and online is Sarah Fisher-Goh, the Executive Director of AEA, and Sean Scaling, who will be doing a more in-depth overview on the Renewable Energy Fund.
Okay. Sarah and Sean, are you on there? If you would, please state your name for the record online.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Sarah Fisher-Goode. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. Emily is going to do most of the presentation. I'm going to save my voice for answering some questions. Our presentation today is somewhat of a general overview of Alaska Energy Authority programs. It's actually been very nice to hear APA member perspectives with respect to the programs that we manage, and I think it's good for legislators to hear from the entities that have a direct relationship and benefit to many of the programs that we manage. So it's very nice to have time in front of House Energy along with APA members. I'm just going to give a couple quick introductions, and again, I know there's a couple PCE slides in this presentation, and we can cover some of the questions that were left on the table after Mira's discussion of PCE. But I did just want to, on the introduction, you know, Alaska Energy Authority, our mission is to reduce the cost of energy in Alaska. We are an independent corporation of the state, and we were created in 1976, and there's been several different adjustments to AEA's power and authority over the years. One of the things that we'll be emphasizing mostly today are a lot of the projects and the programs that have been assigned to it by the legislature under AS 4245. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have Emily start with the program, and Mr. Scaling will pick up on a little bit more of a deeper dive into the Renewable Energy Fund.
Ms. Ford, please proceed then.
Thank you, Chair. So there are a couple of slides here in the beginning about power cost equalization. I know that we did have an in-depth discussion, and we're happy to provide some more information. AEA administers the program. RCA is the regulatory body, and then the fund itself is managed by the Department of Revenue. So there are multiple state entities involved. One thing that I do want to note, a success of ours over the past year, is that AEA's community assistance staff has been working with the Department of Commerce and their local government specialists, and then also the RCA to assist more communities on coming online and being receiving PCE payments. There are several reporting requirements for utilities in order to participate in PCE, and so some utilities have fallen behind, and we've been working very hard to help them get back in the PCE program, and we were able to bring four more communities online, bringing the total participating communities to 192. There are four non-participating communities. This graph here just shows that the power cost equalization program does an effective job at levelizing rates throughout Alaska. The red line there is the floor. That's what we discussed earlier about the average power of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. The yellow indicates the rates that the consumer would pay without PCE, and the blue are the post-PCE rates. And the four highest cost energy communities in the state have a similar story where they have very low populations or declining populations. They are in remote areas where fuel delivery is extremely challenging. And in one case, in ADAC, the infrastructure was built to support a military operation. And so now that the military is gone, there's a small community left with very inefficient building stock. So there's very consistent stories as far as the highest cost communities in the state. The next program we wanted to highlight was our regional energy planning. NEDA's energy planning efforts really began in earnest in 2008 with the publication of the Energy Pathways document. But one lesson learned through that effort was that you cannot take a one-size-fit-all approach to energy planning across the state, and that regional focus is extremely important. As you can imagine, a stakeholder conversation about energy challenges is very different in Southwest Alaska as it is in Southeast Alaska. And so the regional energy planning is really meant to capitalize on local resources, address local challenges, and to create a locally driven and community-vetted blueprint for sustainability. And so the goal is to provide very specific and actionable recommendations. And actually, I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge a partner of ours, Robert Venables, in the room, who has been helping us extensively with our regional planning efforts as well. This map shows the energy regions across the state. They closely follow the ANCSA boundaries. And there are two completed plans, the Rail Belt and Southeast Integrated Resource Plans. Those are very much living documents. And in fact, AEA, as Sarah likes to say, had a reunion tour of sorts in the fall and went back to Sitka with the regional energy planners to discuss the plan and the implementation to see how effective that is going. The ongoing plans, AEA traditionally partners with ARTERS in the region to implement those plans. In the Upper Tanana YK area, we are partnering with the Tanana Chiefs Conference on that plan. And we're on track that those plans should be completed by July. And we'll have specific community and regional priorities included in these documents as well. And there are two plans where AEA is playing an advisory role. That's in the lower YK and then in the North Slope. So the next level of energy planning is what we're referring to as the Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy. Senate Bill 138, which was the gas line legislation that passed last year, included a provision for AEA to conduct a study that will be due January 1st, 2017, on how to deliver more affordable energy to areas of the state that would not be served by a natural gas pipeline. And so this is very much building upon the regional energy plans, but a main distinction between these two is really the funding sources. The regional plans will have those priorities, as I indicated, but they will be very much independent of requiring state funding or state grants, whereas the Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy is asking the question, how do we deliver affordable energy given that a gas line will be coming online and generating significant revenues for the state. So before we began looking at tools on how to lower the cost of energy, it was important to get a snapshot of where we currently are. This is a look at the electrical access to energy, current access. This is not taking into consideration future opportunities. And you can see where communities start to fall in four quadrants of access to energy. They range all the way from access to natural gas and renewables to access to neither natural gas nor renewables. And you can see in this chart the largest quadrant, or the most communities, are in the access that do not have access to natural gas nor renewables. And the heat graph tells very much the same story. And once again, this is a current snapshot. This is not including future potential projects. So where the Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy comes in is, how do we provide more affordable energy? So how can we move a community from one quadrant to another? As we were discussing earlier, is there potential for LNG options in coastal hub areas? Is there a mine that might be coming on in the region that might provide another alternative source of power? Is there a renewable energy project nearby that can help move a community from one quadrant to another? For those communities who don't have access to natural gas or renewable energy, deep energy efficiency updates, making sure that there's safe and affordable infrastructure in the community, safe and efficient infrastructure in the community, the powerhouse, the bulk fuel, energy efficiency, and making sure that things like heat recovery are taken advantage of in those communities. So once we can identify the drivers of costs in a community, we can start identifying the tools that we can use to help reduce that cost of energy. And this report, as I mentioned, will be submitted to the legislature by January 1st, 2017. AEA's energy efficiency and conservation efforts are focused primarily on commercial buildings, rural public buildings, industrial facilities, and electrical efficiency. We do lead the Alaska Energy Efficiency Partnership, which is a stakeholder group of 40-plus stakeholders, state entities. There's some federal partners, also nonprofits and regional entities and utilities as well. Key statistic that we like to point out is that our Alaska Commercial Energy Audit Program, so measures that are identified through that program and then implemented, do produce a 30% immediate savings. And you do have copies of our annual report and also the Renewable Energy Fund Status Fund at your desks, and then for those who are online or in the audience, they are available online at AKEnergyAuthority.org. One of the projects that is highlighted in the annual report is revisiting Night Mute. So 5 years ago, there was a deep whole village retrofit of energy efficiency measures deployed in Night Mute, where there were multiple state, federal agencies, regional entities, nonprofits that all came together and implemented these energy efficiency measures simultaneously in the community. And those included weatherization, upgrades to building stock and commercial buildings, lighting, and different energy efficiency measures. So this fall, we reconvened that stakeholder group to ask, was this an effective model? Should we be deploying this model in other communities? Is it effective to bring all of these resources to bear in one community at a single time? So the stakeholder group and also NuVista and Cold Climate Housing Center revisited NuVista this fall and had a listening session with elders and also with the community, and then went back and evaluated those efficiency measures. And there was a couple of lessons learned. First, that the state's energy efficiency programs work. The community village store was seeing an estimated about $11,000 worth of savings annually. So for a small community, the village store, that's a significant amount of money. There is a significant amount of benefit to community buy-in in the process, engaging the community. And in the case of Night Mute, they actually were able to extend some of the programs by providing their own capital to the effort as well. There is an extensive need for continued and ongoing education and education about the maintenance of those efforts as well, especially when you have a community that's as young in age as Night Mute, where you have people who are in their early teens during the 5 years ago during the initial retrofit. So that continued and ongoing education is critical to maintain those efforts. So the brick and mortar programs of AEA are bulk fuel and rural powerhouse upgrades. We have traditionally, in around 2000, the Denali Commission provided funding for bulk fuel upgrades. That funding has declined in recent years, so AEA has been completing those programs, and also our rural powerhouse upgrades. Two additional programs that are related to these efforts are our circuit rider and emergency response efforts. The circuit rider is providing mechanical assistance, training, and troubleshooting for a lot of rural powerhouse operators. That can be done over the phone. If a utility has a SCADA system that we're able to connect with, we can actually walk people through challenges that we're seeing. Or our circuit riders actually travel to communities as well and provide that hands-on maintenance and assistance. Emergency response, from AEA's perspective, we can provide assistance when a community has lost power or is near a lights out situation. So that way, once again, we can do it over the phone to walk people through, or we also deploy mechanics to the community and emergency generators as well if needed. So we thought it was important to look at our rural powerhouse system upgrade program essentially as a grant program to the communities, and how effective is it to our mission of reducing the cost of energy in Alaska? Sorry, bumping into the microphone. So if our mission is to reduce the cost of energy, so how effective is the RPSU program? And what we found is that the community, especially the small communities, had to debt finance the upgrade to a powerhouse. There would be a increase by 19 cents per kilowatt hour. So by providing these grant fundings, we are helping to reduce the cost of energy for those communities. As was mentioned earlier, the Emerging Energy Technology Fund fills a critical void in technology, where it's for programs that can be brought or have the reasonable expectation to be brought to commercialization within 5 years. Those include renewables, fossil fuels, efficiency measures, technologies that are either new to Alaska, that are existing technologies that can be improved, or new technologies completely. And we've done two successful rounds of solicitation. The first round was $9 million, 4.5 was state funds, another 4.5 million was Denali Commission funds, and then we did a second solicitation of $2 million. This past summer was actually quite exciting because there were three different hydrokinetic projects that were being tested in Alaska this past summer. And it really put the spotlight on the state for hydrokinetic research and development of those technologies to see if they are able to be deployed in a lot of these rural communities.
Could you, do you have a slide of the turbine in the Krijak River?
Yes.
Have any of those in-river turbines worked out? I think the institute at the university is testing those. we had any positive results?
All three were able to produce power at some point. And so Sean Skilling's online, and he has some additional information about the varying success rates. I know that ASAP does have a test bed near Tanana, and then there was one in the Kwajak River as well. So Sean, do you have some more specifics on the hydrokinetic projects?
Yes, hello, Chairman. Sean Skilling, Director at Alaska Energy Authority. There were three successful deployments. As Emily said, you know, a lot of the challenges here are just in design, implementation, testing moorings, deploying and retrieving successfully, and a lot of those pieces. So good progress was made. A couple of the devices will be put back in the river next summer for kind of the next stage of testing. And so I think at this point we can call it successful, though probably not economically competitive yet. But that's the whole purpose of the program, is to help these emerging technologies get through to commercialization.
Was, I suppose, silt and snags and those kind of things are a challenge. Was the design that works, is it a submerged design that is not affected by ice or drifting logs and whatnot?
Mr. Chairman, the three designs are actually three different designs. The picture that you see in the bottom left corner there is the device before deployment. So it's on floating, I'm not sure what you call it.
Pontoons,
I guess.
Yes.
Thanks. And so once it's in place, then it's sunk to the bottom, and those pontoons sit on the bottom. And so this would, what you're seeing is the spinning turbine as it would sit on the bottom. A second one was also bottom mounted, and a third is actually surface mounted from a barge. It sits down several feet under the barge and captures the energy going by. The reason for using the Kwajak River in particular is because it's a very clean water source. You can see through the water, and there's very little debris that floats down. There is a test bed, as you mentioned, on the Nanana River as well, where they've been testing debris diversion and other things in addition to the technology devices.
Okay, thank you. And then on that same slide, the picture of the ground source heat loop, are those economic to install, like in the interior by a consumer? And is that off-the-shelf technology? How is that proving out to we're always looking for a way to heat our homes cheaper, especially in the interior.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the purpose of the testing here that you're seeing in Fairbanks is to try to test the boundaries of this, you know, essentially a commercially viable technology, but that hasn't been tested in such a cold climate. So far, I think that is showing a successful deployment. They're also testing over the years how it affects the ground temperature with different surface treatments. In other words, how much can the sun warm the soils in the summertime and carry it through to the winter, or does it end up cooling the soil overall? So generally, where it works best is where you have low electric costs and high heating fuel costs, because essentially what you're doing is using extra electricity to pump the heat out of the ground.
Okay, so like Southeast, if you're in Wrangell and you got cheap hydro, a lot of those people went to electric baseboard, and I think their load increased quite a bit, but if you're able to put a ground heat loop or use a tidal loop, and you had cheaper power hydro, then it might pencil out?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's the best place where you have those two conditions and generally a warmer climate as well. And the nice thing about the ground source heat pumps is that they, rather than a baseboard heater that uses one unit of energy and produces one unit of heat, these use one unit of energy and generally produce two or three units of heat.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rule, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions on both these sources. I've talked to some contractors in Fairbanks that actually are installing heat pumps with success. So it's just, and they tell me that it's actually saving money. And so, have you heard of that?
Through the chair, I've heard of some different projects around the state. I'm not sure I know the ones that you're talking about, but we're always interested in getting more data points on what's working well.
Okay, one more question. The river turbines, are they, what kind of output do they have? My understanding is the power output is fairly low for the size and complexity of the apparatus. Is that correct?
Through the chair, I believe you're on the right track. I'm trying to remember the exact specifications. I think with the turbine that's pictured there had an output of 50 kW or something along those lines. In the community's vision of how they might deploy it, it would be a couple of those devices to supply, you know, a community load that I think is on average 250 or 200. And so even though it is relatively small, it's also serving a small community. But like I said before, it still has hurdles to get over, and primarily the economics is a challenge until they can be produced more. Oh, and I was going to add one thing. Right now, some of these deployments are, you know, tooling up and crafting improvements based on what they learned last summer. So this is all the development of the technology that's coming along.
Thank you. Thank you. Please proceed.
So the next slide, we could probably spend an entire committee meeting discussing just this project alone, but it was at least worth including as an AEA project. So Susitna Watona Hydro, we are in a FERC licensing process. We are we do have an advance in the schedule at this time. The project, if constructed, would provide roughly 50% of the rail belt electricity, and it's located about River Mile 189, and the Susitna River would be the site. And all of the financing plans and engineering feasibility reports and cost estimates have shown that the project could provide wholesale power at 50 year average rates of 6 cents per kilowatt hour.
Hang on a second. I understand that to get you to FERC licensing, it's a $100 million budget request, and existing funding left is $25 million, is that correct?
Yes.
And you have a number of fishery studies going on the Susitna drainage.
Mm-hmm.
With that $25 million, what is the research plan for this summer? Is the project on hold? Or are we going to go ahead and continue? What is the work schedule looking like with the remaining funds?
Sarah, perhaps you have a better answer for the plan moving forward with Susitna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Sarah Fisher-Goad again. With the response that we've provided to Administrative Order 271, one of the six projects, we provide information, and essentially what we have what we have currently encumbered is really to complete some of the reports from the data and the information that we collected this past year in our field season. And right now at this point, you know, we are continuing to evaluate what our licensing options are. Having had some conversations with FERC, we'll be reporting back to the governor's office with respect to, you know, what we've learned with respect to if the project was to not receive funding for a while, what our options are to, you know, make sure that we're able to preserve the investment that the state of Alaska has already made. But still, you know, have opportunities in the future to look at what it would take to actually get this project licensed. And yes, you are correct that the $100 million is what our estimate is to complete the study plan that FERC has approved in the study plan determination. But right now, we are at an abeyance with FERC and have the schedule suspended until. We work out and look at the various options that we have. And at this point, I if we do anything, if we're able to continue with the project in any manner, there would be minimal to none work really done in the field this season.
Okay, thank you, Director Goad. Can I ask you a follow-up then? Of the fisheries research, in other words, we've had fish wheels, there's been a large research project, genetics, in the Susitna drainages. Is that work, scope of work completed as far as the field data, and it's just genetic lab work and analyzing and preparing reports? I'm concerned because there's about three different efforts going on in the Susitna drainage, the Department of Fish and Game, Susitna, and then some other efforts on looking at that drainage and salmon habitat and distribution of species and production levels. So,
yeah, Mr. Chairman, the work that we have done, we certainly are not completed with the work that we need to do in the field to have enough information and data for a license application to FERC. And I'm glad, though, that you mentioned, though, the other work that's going on in the basin with respect to the Susitna River. We do know that the work that we have done is very valuable to Fish and Game in their efforts to manage the fisheries and the resources in the area. And we've been very closely coordinated with Fish and Game on that. And in fact, we wanted to make sure that we were very coordinated so there wouldn't be any type of duplication of effort on the additional work that they're doing. So Fish and Game has actually been the lead agency to do some of the fisheries work in the area on behalf of the project. And so I think all that work has been very, very well coordinated. But so there is the coordination. However, would not necessarily say our field seasons are completed. We do need additional field work, but would need the funding to be able to do that work.
Okay. Well, with respect to the fisheries research, if you could provide the committee with a spreadsheet of what all the project work to date has been done and where you're at on the reports on those, and the coordinating agency was Fish and Game, and then what of the scope of work of the research plan as far as fisheries is concerned in the drainage is yet to be done, and who are the points of contact and the managers of the data so that we can. My concern is, Director, that we not lose the. If the project is winding down, some of these people may be hard to find and locate. I'd like to be able to harness the data and get it into the hands of the people that can use it. There's a heightened emphasis on restoration of about 8 of 12 stocks of concern statewide are in that drainage. And so we need good science to help develop what the plan is going forward. So I appreciate any and all a status report, what's left to be done, the points of contact so we can forward that on to other agencies and folks working on this. Thank you.
Yes, we will do that, Mr. Chairman, and I think we'll maybe take an offline conversation to discuss with you a little bit more in detail of that information. A lot of that information has been submitted in our admin order response that has been posted on the OMB webpage. But we'll certainly, use that as our starting point and work with you and your staff to get the information that you're looking for to you.
I appreciate it. And then there's a number of other legislators that are key in on this issue that have funded different projects too. So I look forward to working with you on that. We're concerned is that we want to make sure the data is available, it's used, that we don't lose all the good work that's been done and get that implemented into future plans and management of the resource.
We appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Ford, go ahead.
And actually, at this point, I turn it over to Sean Scaling for a more in-depth discussion on the Renewable Energy Grant Fund.
Hello again, committee. This is Sean Scaling. if I may, I'm curious about the time.
We have about about 13 minutes. So, if you want to, is most of your proposal or presentation on the fund and what's being done with it and the results?
Yes, that's the remainder of my talk.
Okay, well, perhaps you can hit on the highlights of the success and challenges.
Yes, certainly. So what I'm going to do is just a few slides on overview, the status of the projects and the program, and then so those are the past projects, and then recommendations that have just recently been put forward for round 8 this year's funding, and then highlight a couple stories.
So on this first slide, the things I would note is, you know, this does help toward the goal of the 50% renewable electricity by 2025. It provides a great vetting mechanism for the legislature so that we, you know, it is a grant application program, so we seek applications, analyze them, recommend projects to the legislature, and along with that comes a really strong technical and economic evaluation. Of course, this capitalizes on local energy resources. One thing that we haven't talked about a lot is the expanding knowledge base of renewable energy in Alaska. It's really pretty amazing how far we've come in these 7 or 8 years and how much, you know, state employees know, communities know, the contractors who build and operate the projects, or generally build the projects and communities that operate them. It's been a long, or it's been a really strong learning curve. Local employment is huge, and then of course the benefits, I'll touch later on the life cycle benefits for the first 44 projects completed, is about $900 million over the life of the projects, and that is dispersed to a nice variety of recipients, you know, namely mostly the local utility or the local local communities and utilities, but also businesses, as was touched upon earlier during the PCE conversation, and even the state's expenses through paying school utility bills and the PCE program as well. Pictured there is the Coffin Cove school garn boiler that is being stoked at the time. This is a high-efficiency, low-emissions boiler system, and that's all that the program funds, is the high-efficiency, low-emission, really hot, fast burn, and then you store the energy to use as needed. Next slide, please. So I talked about the economic evaluations. Strong emphasis on high cost of energy areas, as again was noted in the APA presentation, and then the regional balance of the distribution of the funds and the benefits. Just for review, eligible applicants are utilities, local governments, tribal councils, and IPPs, and eligible projects are wind, hydro, biomass, heat recovery. Those are our main ones, and then additionally, I've listed other eligible projects. When I say main ones, those are the ones that tend to be have the strongest technical and economic basis. New this year, we posted on the website with the applications checklist for successful applications, just so all applicants are on the same playing field, so we're all learning together. Things that we've learned in recent years, the applicants can know so they can put together stronger applications. And the last review slide is just some of the achievements. This past fall, AEA and Kodiak Electric were recognized with a national award from the Clean Energy States Alliance, kind of a national excellence award. Kodiak, by the way, is 99% renewable energy, renewable electricity, and that combined with the Renewable Energy Fund is what won that award. 15 million gallons of diesel, approximately, were displaced in 2014. Sometimes these big numbers kind of roll right through my head, but if you picture a 1,000-gallon tank and then picture 15,000 of them lined up, that's your 15 million gallons, so it's not a small amount of diesel displaced. The overall program cost ratio is 2.8, cost-benefit ratio, and I'll touch on that a little bit later. And next slide, please. This is just a summary of a few of the key numbers. I'll focus on just a few. The applications funded, 277 have been funded in the first 7 rounds. That's about 38% of the applications received. We do fund in phases often, so we'll fund feasibility to make sure that the project is feasible before giving money for design and or construction. And so those 277 grants represent about 200 distinct projects. And we have currently about 125 grants in place. And of course, the appropriated amount was mentioned earlier, a little under $250 million, $247. Next slide shows a map of all of the projects funded and their resource type. And one thing that's interesting here is you, of course, need to have the local resource near the local community, like quite adjacent to it. And so you'll see there's wind along the west coast. There's hydro where there's rain and terrain, generally southeast and south-central, biomass where there are trees. And next slide, please. This shows the dollars allocated to each different type. About 70% is wind and hydro, and then biomass and heat recovery and others follow after that.
Mr. Chair.
Hang on. Representative Wolf, get a question.
Yeah, I'm just noticing that solar is 0.5%. According to previous map of all the diagrams around the state, there's a lot of solar diagrams, but 0.5%, does that seem low, or is that just me?
Through the chair, Representative, solar are very small projects, and some of those are actually feasibility studies as well. But they're basically low dollar cost projects and low generation as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Next slide is the shows funding by region. Just to get a picture of it, as I mentioned earlier, there's a strong emphasis on regional equity. That said, it's a grant program, and so we receive applications we qualify applications that come in. And next slide is very similar information. Same financials, but it also shows a count of the number of grants and percentages. Moving right along, this next slide, one of my favorites. This shows fuel displaced, kind of diesel equivalent gallons displaced year to year. And as many of you recall, in the early years, as we were getting through the early phases and construction and getting on to construction, it took some time for the projects to develop, and now they are really producing a lot of energy and expected to continue to grow. The 2014 number, you'll notice, as annualized, that's the first three quarters then put into annual numbers. I think it probably will grow just a little bit more, so it's just under 15 million gallons. And next slide, please. This slide shows the value generated from the first 44 projects in operation. So of those projects, roughly $100 million was Renewable Energy Fund and $200 million was other sources of funding to build those projects, which is the left bar showing about $300 million, so total costs. And then the total life cycle benefits is on the right. So you can see, not even just looking at the Renewable Energy Fund costs, but the overall construction process, including match, have this benefit cost ratio of 2.8 that I mentioned before. The life of the projects in that right column is generally 20 years for wind and biomass, for example, and 50 for hydro. And next slide, please. So moving from past performance into the recommendations for this year. This year, AEA, on its recommended projects list, are 40 projects totaling $28.3 million. We didn't recommend 26 projects. Of those 40 projects, we then fit within the governor's budget of $15 million and recommend 34 projects, which includes funding caps, as we discussed with the advisory committee. So it ends up being 18 heat projects for $5.1 million and 16 standard projects. We call it standard because it's generally electric, but it also includes transmission and storage and other related. And again, I touched on that regional distribution equity. It was quite a long conversation with the Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee this year, just making sure that we're being fair to all regions. And the next slide, please. I'll go pretty quickly through these, but
yeah, could you please summarize? You got about a couple minutes left. You got a couple real cool ones: the Thorn Bay biomass. I think there's one in Tok too, and then Eulaquit Wind. Just looking at you, slides ahead.
Yeah. So certainly, those next four are really quick, just summaries. So I can jump right to the Thorn Bay biomass. There's been a tremendous growth in understanding of biomass and how it works. And with biomass, because it has a big labor component of feeding the system and harvesting the wood locally, there's great job creation that goes along with it, but you also need a great commitment from the community. So Thorn Bay is fully committed. They put in, through the Renewable Energy Fund and also a Wood Energy Development Task Group, which is a really diverse stakeholder group, funded feasibility and construction through those two funding sources. They put in biomass boiler, and it has excess heat that they're able to heat the greenhouse, grow vegetables. There's a whole curriculum from the school that's going on it. They are providing the vegetables they grow in the school lunch and selling the others locally. So it's just a really neat project, and a lot of other communities seem to be looking at that and trying to figure out ways to do something similar. And the last slide and the last story is Unalakleet Wind. This was actually a relatively early renewable energy fund project. They put up 600 kW wind turbines. It wasn't without its challenges, though, because it was an early project. We didn't know everything then that we know now. So we've worked really well with the community and the vendors over the years to incrementally make improvements to the system, and it's been working really well, and the community has been operating that with a strong emphasis on really good performance. And the last thing I'd want to say is just that our status, this presentation has been a summary of the status report that all legislators received. It's also on AEA's website, and there are other things as well, like AEA's project evaluation summaries and status of all past projects. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, and thank you to our presenters. We'll take a brief at ease and take up House Bill 58. For those of you in the audience that didn't get the Renewable Energy Fund report, we have some extra copies around if you like that. So we'll take a brief at ease and set up for a presentation on the legislation. House Energy Committee meeting back to order at 11:47. We have a presentation on House Bill 58 from Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins. Please proceed. State your name for the record. Go. A brief at ease. Back on record, Representative Tallarico.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that the committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 58, LS-0254/8, as the working document.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. Without objection, the CS is on the table, and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Culver. For the record, my name is Jonathan Christ Tompkins. I represent rural Southeast Alaska. House Bill 58, or CS for House Bill 58, is a bill that Representative Millett and myself are advancing through the process, and it concerns the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund, which is a mouthful of an acronym, and I understand this committee has already had a presentation on already. And as I'm sure the committee learned, in learning more about this revolving loan fund since its creation in 2010, it has effectively not been used at all, despite having capitalization potential of $250 million. Its goal is really admirable. It's to make buildings in Alaska more energy efficient. That's up there with puppies and kittens, is something that we all believe in. So this bill, especially in this fiscal environment where we don't really have money everywhere to spend or to disperse as grants, is to create more value with a fund that already exists. So one of the reasons in our research that the AEERLF has not been used is that why would anyone bother for a loan if you can get a grant? And the legislature's been giving a lot of grants out when we had big multi-billion dollar surpluses. Now we're in the pretty much opposite environment, so we think there's going to be a lot more interest in this fund, or we hope there is, because people won't have access to free money. And so our intent in order to, I guess, scale the potential of people making energy efficiency improvements is to allow nonprofits and tribes to also access this revolving loan fund, in addition to public entities such as school districts and municipalities that presently can access the revolving loan fund. So, in a nutshell, that's what this bill does, and I hope to answer any questions or entertain any improvements to the legislation as it's presently written.
Any members of the committee have any questions for the sponsor, Representative Tallarico?
I have to excuse myself because I have another thing coming, but I wanted to thank Representative Christ Tompkins for bringing that forward and coming down here to the committee meeting today. Thank you.
Thank you. So this basically opens up this loan fund for
nonprofits and federally recognized tribes, native organizations?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you for your presentation. We'll open it up for testimony in the room and online. Anybody else as far on the committee have any questions for the sponsor? Okay, thank you. Thank you, and we'll open it up for public testimony in the room. Anyone wish to testify on House Bill 58? Online, do we have anybody? We don't have anybody online. So we'll close the public hearing and hold the bill and bring it back another day for action. And with that, a bit of housekeeping to close out our meeting. On Thursday, we'll have Chief Executive Officer of Golden Valley Electric, Corey Borgerson, presenting on understanding energy in the interior. Look forward to his leadership. A number of issues out there right now as far as how to solve energy solutions in Fairbanks and the interior. And then we'll hear from David Gillespie, CEO of the Alaska Railbelt Cooperative Transmission and Electric Company, on industry restructuring. And also we'll have on the calendar bills previously heard and scheduled. So with that, if there's nothing else for the good of the order, we'll adjourn until our next meeting on Thursday.